not counting the introduction, form a unit referred often as the Book of Signs. Sometimes the entire gospel is called the Gospel of Signs. John prefers the word that is translated sign over the word miracle. In fact, he uses the word sign more than any other New Testament writer. And the reason he prefers sign over miracle is not because he doesn't believe in miracles, but because he believes that we shouldn't base our faith on miracles. Rather, we should trust in the one to whom the miracles point. See the difference? So John wrote a book about the signs of Jesus. A sign is meant to communicate a message. Jesus did not perform these miraculous signs in order to entertain the crowds. He wasn't some sort of traveling magician trying to earn his keep through tricks and illusions. Rather, these signs point to the identity of Jesus and the kind of new life he offers. And thus, these signs lead to faith in the crucified and risen Lord. The first sign that John records for us took place at a wedding in the Galilean village of Cana. The next day, there was a wedding celebration in the village of Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the celebration. What do you do when you and your mother are at the same party? Now, I suppose it may depend on how old you are. If you're 5, hey, that may seem like a great time. On the other hand, if you're 15, probably your worst nightmare. Jesus went to a party with his mother. The occasion was a wedding near his home in Nazareth. Weddings in ancient Palestine were highly joyous occasions, and they were usually held in the middle of the week. After the ceremony, the couple did not leave. Instead, they kept an open house for 7 days. And during these 7 days, they were treated like royalty. They often dressed the part, even gave out orders to their subjects. It was all in great fun. Ancient rabbis told their students that nothing must interfere with the study of the Word of God, with one exception: a wedding. If they were invited to a wedding, they were to drop everything and join the celebration. So you see, there's a madness to this method. Why is Jesus at this wedding feast, and why is this being communicated to us? Well, if you think about it, is it any wonder that Jesus uses a wedding feast to represent his invitation to us? We're to drop everything and follow him to experience a joy that lasts not 7 days, but forever. This passage is teaching us that through Jesus we can have a fulfilled life. And what do we mean by a fulfilled life? Well, first of all, a fulfilled life means that relationships matter to us. As you may have noticed, the wedding feast was in trouble. Why? They ran out of wine. Now, to us, this probably seems like a social embarrassment. But actually, it was more than that. The host family, which in those days was the groom's side, was liable for the quality of the feast. So if a guest felt neglected, or if the party ran out of food, or worse, they ran out of wine, this was grounds for a lawsuit. So this family from Cana was in deep trouble on a day that should have been their happiest. Mary noticed what was happening. So she turned to Jesus and said, "They have no wine." She did that not because she thought Jesus didn't know what was going on. It wasn't to inform him. She did that because she wanted him to do something. Jesus made a curt reply, "Woman, what have you to do with me?" Now, the New Living Translation tries to soften it. It says, "Dear woman." But you have to understand, in the original, there's only one word, and it's not dear. But this word may not mean what we think it means. The term that is used here and translated as woman is used later in the gospel. Jesus is dying on the cross. He's concerned about what's going to happen to his mother. And so she entrusts him into John's care. A poignant moment. He uses the same term here as found at the wedding in Cana. The term is used elsewhere in literature. This is how Odysseus addressed his beloved Penelope, his wife. This is how Caesar addressed Cleopatra. So the term is not a rude vulgarity, but rather one that expresses the highest level of respect and affection. Healthy relationships need respect. They need to be marked by respect. A healthy friendship, a healthy marriage, a healthy working relationship needs mutual respect. If we do not show respect, if we do not guard one another's dignity, then we shouldn't be surprised if our relationships blow up in our faces. We need to treat people the way Jesus would treat people. Two, a fulfilled life means carrying out our purpose. Jesus said to Mary, "My time has not yet come." Or more literally, "My hour has not yet come." And this phrase is used over and over again in the New Testament, and it always refers to the crucifixion of Jesus. As C.G. Cruz puts it, the hour towards which everything moves is the hour of Jesus' glorification, which takes place through his death, resurrection, and exaltation. John wants us to know that even early in Jesus' ministry, he was conscious of a divine purpose that would culminate in an extraordinary climax. Now, it's possible that at some time or another, Jesus mentioned this idea of a messianic feast to his mother. Maybe that's where she heard of it. Or maybe because there was a tradition about this, she was just familiar with this tradition about the messianic feast. The messianic feast, or the messianic banquet, is a symbol of the blessings of the age to come when those chosen by God share in a rich feast with the Messiah. In the New Testament, This is often pictured as a marriage banquet with Jesus as the groom and the church as the bride, as well as the invited guests. This feast will take place when the kingdom of God is consummated. This feast is prefigured in the Lord's Supper. In any case, Jesus' reply makes it clear that it was not yet time for this prophesied feast. Jesus had great respect for his mother, but that did not mean he would do anything or everything she told him to do. His ultimate allegiance was to God. He did not see his life as a series of wishes, like we often do, you know. I wish that would happen to me. I wish I could receive that. I wish I could do those things. I wish. If we keep that up, we'll never be happy. How do we experience a fulfilled life? Look to Jesus. Jesus did not see his life as a series of wishes. He saw his life as a purpose to be fulfilled. Life is to be experienced in the fullness of God's grace. And so if you want to have a fulfilled life, you need to discover your purpose and to carry it out. Now, according to Mike Royko, who wrote for the Chicago Tribune, is that a name that, okay. One of his articles, he mentions this guy named Bill Mallory. Apparently, Bill Mallory traveled to India because he wanted to find the purpose of life. Well, he spent a lot of time there, but he never got an answer to his question. What is the purpose of life? So he came back to the United States, and he happened to stop at a Chevron station. It's a gas station. We don't really have Chevrons around here, do we? Which is the same as this thing on my sleeve, in case you're wondering. It's not Sergeant Stripes. These are Chevrons. But he stopped at a Chevron station, and the sign on the front of the Chevron station said, "As you travel, ask us." So he thought he would. What is the purpose of life? These are the responses he got. The first one said, sorry, I'm new here. The second one said, I don't remember anything in the manual about that. Another one said, I'm not much for church myself, sir. And one gave him a leering look and then a wink, whatever that meant. But most people just returned a blank stare and went on to their business. Well, one day he gets a call from Chevron Corporate. And they ask him, they say, "We understand that you've been asking our dealers questions and getting unsatisfactory answers." And so the representative suggested that Mallory write to Chevron in a self-addressed stamp envelope his question. So he did. He wrote down, "What is the purpose of life?" Put it in the envelope, mailed it off. A couple weeks later, he got a reply, an envelope from Chevron Corporate. You know what was in it? A credit card application. The purpose of life, right? Well, if you want to know the purpose of life, then you're going to need to talk to the one who made you. You were made by and for God. Until you understand that, life is not going to make sense. 3, a fulfilled life means turning to the Lord. Mary is a paradigm of faith. When she sensed trouble, she turned instinctively to Jesus. A healthy faith turns to Jesus no matter what the circumstance. Jesus said to her, "What have I to do with you?" Again, the New Living Translation softens it a bit. That's not our problem. Now, this term also sounds rude to us, and it may or may not have sounded rude to Mary. It depends on how Jesus said it. Because this phrase, "What have I to do with you," is a translation of an Aramaic expression. And it has two different meanings depending on how it was said. If it's said in anger, then it rivals the crudest expression that we can come up with to dismiss someone from our presence. All right? I'm not going to give you an example. You just kind of filled out that blank in your head, all right? If he said it in anger. Now, we don't have a recording of how he said it, but we do have the context. What did he just say moments before? He used a term that refers to the highest level of respect. So I don't think he said it in anger. I think he said it gently. And if this expression is said gently, this is what it means. I know you don't understand, but that's okay. I will do what is right. Faith does not mean we always understand what God is doing. And that's okay, because we can trust God to do what is right. Did you notice how Mary got other people involved? She got the banquet staff involved. She got the servants involved. Got them to pay attention to Jesus. And by the way, that's another mark of healthy faith. Healthy faith not only turns to Jesus in all circumstances, it encourages others to do the same. Number four, a fulfilled life means entrusting our dreams to God. Jesus did do something. He did something extraordinary. He performed his first recorded miracle. He turned water into wine, lots of it. There are some Christians, even some pastors who are uncomfortable with this. It's almost as if they wish this passage was not in the Bible. And their reasoning goes something like this. Well, I can see Jesus doing a miracle to give sight to the blind or heal the sick or feed a hungry crowd. But why waste a miracle on a party? But this stems from a misunderstanding of the nature of the new life Christ offers us. It isn't a meager, sorrowful existence that Christ offers. Jesus said, "I have told you this, that my joy may be in you, and that your joy may be full." John 15:11. And then he also said, "I came that they may have life and have it abundantly." John 10:10. Or as our New Living Translation puts it, "My purpose is to give them a rich and satisfying life." Christ offers us an abundant life, a new kind of life. The master of ceremonies tasted the new wine. He was astonished at the superior quality. The clear implication represented by this superior wine is that the quality of the new life that Christ offers is beyond our earthly limitations, beyond our wildest dreams. If you had been a Greek believer of the first century, and you heard this story, you may have thought about your own myths and legends where various gods and goddesses turn water into wine. People knew they were myths, but it was a common story and a source of entertainment. Now, there was something called the Fountain Triglyph or Triglyph Wall in Corinth. The Fountain Triglyph was a lot like a wishing well. What do you do at a wishing well? Well, you part with some money and you make a wish hoping your dreams will come true, okay? Similar idea with this Fountain Triglyph. By the way, triglyph, it just means there were three marks on it, okay? But it sounds more impressive to say triglyph than to say fountain with three marks on it. So this Fountain Triglyph, which is also part of some kind of a wall, was in Corinth. And it kind of looked like a masonry altar. It was man-made. And on either side were concrete gutters. So the concrete gutter would run into the altar, disappear, and then come out the other side. All right? Now, if someone wanted to use it, they would pay the priest money and pour some wine on one side and see what happened on the other side. If it came out water on the other side, oh, too bad, bad luck. But if it came out wine on the other side, then your wish was granted. Your dreams would come true. That was the Fountain Triglyph. Now, I was fortunate years ago to be able to do on-site research at the ruins of ancient Corinth. And there is indeed the remains of this triglyph wall in the marketplace of the ruins of ancient Corinth. And there is a kind of an altar, and it's definitely fashioned by human hands. But what I noticed is that the inside was hollow, where a person could hide secretly. And there is a way to divert the water. So you can see how this works, right? So if the priest, if you didn't pay enough money to the priest, or if the priest just didn't like you, you put the water in, and water came out. The guy in the secret inside wouldn't divert it. But apparently if you paid enough money, you pour the wine in, the guy on the inside would divert it and then pour some wine. So the wine came out the other side. Ta-da! A miracle! Not a lot has changed in 3,000 years. I hope you realize that. Well, were people really that gullible back then? I don't know. But you know, most of us realize that a wishing well is not real. I mean, there's nothing magical about it. So I'm inclined to think that most people realize that the triglyph wall was not supernatural. But what a cool idea that would be if there was somebody who could actually turn water into wine. Well, some of these people heard about a guy who could really do it, who could turn water into wine. And they realized, if there really was someone who could turn water into wine, he would also have the power to fulfill our dreams. But not just any dream. If your dreams are selfish, if you wish to rule over people, if you want untold riches, if you want to satisfy forbidden desires, then your dreams will come to naught. But if you want friendship with God, if you want a fulfilled life as God intended, if you want love, joy, and peace to last forever, then trust your dream to Jesus Christ, and he'll do even more than you ask. 5, a fulfilled life means a new kind of life that lasts forever. Now, you may have caught a reference to these 6 stone jars. Jewish believers hearing this story would have had a kind of a different take on this. They wouldn't have thought about the triglyph wall and whatever that could mean. But they were aware of these 6 jars. They were used for ceremonial washing. And six was symbolic. It was symbolic of incompleteness. The ceremonial jars represented what Old Testament religion had become. The Jewish believers knew that the law was good, but they themselves had no power to fulfill it. The law was good, but it had no power to bring about a good life, a righteous life. Now along comes Jesus, who can do what we cannot. He fulfills the law. He reconciles us to God. He brings new life out of old. Something else I find interesting here is there's no mention of the ceremony. This whole passage is about the wedding feast. And I think this speaks volumes about the kind of life that Christ offers us. Over the years, I've had the privilege of marrying many couples. Some couples were quite obvious in their love for Jesus. Others, not as obvious. They wanted Jesus to be part of the ceremony. You know, they wanted a religious ceremony in the church. But it was not always clear to me if they wanted Jesus to also come to their party and to their married lives thereafter. This passage is promoting the opposite of conventional expectations for weddings. Yes, it's okay to have a religious ceremony. If you have a religious ceremony, that's fine. Nothing wrong with it. But the real question is whether you're inviting Jesus to your party. It's okay to say your solemn vows before God and your witnesses. That's fine. Nothing wrong with that. But asking God to be part of your everyday life leads to eternal joy. Well, there's an awful lot in this passage, and we could spend a great deal more time. If you're like me, you have your share of ups and downs in life. There are problems, there are questions, struggles. Lyman Coleman, who is best known for his Serendipity series, asked this question based on this passage. Where do you need to see water turn to wine in your life? In just a few moments, we'll be sharing in the Lord's Supper. We will taste and see the representation of the blood of Christ shed for us. As you look into the cup of blessing, ask the Lord to change the water into wine in your life. If you feel weak, confused, or in pain, ask the Lord to turn the water into wine in your life. If you feel unworthy, if you have many doubts, if you struggle each day, why am I here? Then ask the Lord to turn the water into wine in your life. If you're feeling dumb, foolish, like your brain's on vacation, then ask the Lord to turn the water into wine in your life. If you feel lonely, dry, out of sync with God and His church, then ask the Lord to turn the water into wine in your life. If you feel worn out, used up, ready to quit, then ask the Lord to turn the water into wine in your life. Ask the Lord to turn the water into wine in your life. God will answer that prayer, but it may not be the answer you expected. It may not be an answer you understand, but that's okay. You can trust God to do the right thing and enable you to live a life filled with His love and grace.